This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Hello, this is Alert, radio for people who want to change the world. I'm your host, Leslie Hughes, here with our last show of the season and with...
André Clément. This week on our show, it's time for MayWorks and all that that implies. What does it imply anyway? Mona Valentine, a director with QP, will spell it out for us.
And stay with us for our conversation with Canada's preeminent social historian, Brian Palmer of Trent University. He'll take us back to the magic May in the magic year of 1968.
Stay tuned for Alert's unique headlines.
Yes, sirree, Bob. And for Around the Left in 7 days.
These are the Alert headlines for the week of May 1st, 2008.
Mordecai Bromberg, well-known campaigner for the rights of Palestinians and an end to war and racism, has won the YMCA's Power of Peace Award this weekend. The YMCA of Greater Vancouver picked Bromberg for the International Peacemaker Award from a field of 9 nominees to honor people working to change the world. While teaching sociology at Simon Fraser University in the 60s, Bromberg helped establish the Committee to Aid War Objectors to provide support for American war resistors seeking refuge in Canada. His anti-nuclear weapon campaigns continued in Vancouver with End the Arms Race and the efforts to free jailed Israeli nuclear programmer whistleblower Mordecai Vanunu. Bromberg went on to help found the Canada-Palestine Network and served on the board of the Near East Cultural and Educational Foundation, whose projects include providing mental health services for Palestinian children traumatized by violence. Bromberg's commitment to education extends beyond the classroom. He helped to found a newspaper called The Western Voice and is now a host of Co-op Radio's Red Eye program. Interviewed on Alert 3 weeks ago, Bromberg is currently being sued by Canwest Global, owners of the Vancouver Sun and the province, for producing a parody of the Sun and its pro-Israel editorial policies. Though Bromberg had nothing to do with the production of the parody, Canwest cited his pro-Palestinian work as the reason he is being sued. The Seriously Free Speech Committee has been formed in support and to help raise funds for his defense. If you'd like more information, you'll find it at www.seriouslyfreespeech.ca.
Soaring food prices are a massacre of the world's poor and are creating a global nutritional crisis, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said on Tuesday, calling it a sign that capitalism is in decline. His comments came only hours after the United Nations World Food Program called more expensive food a silent tsunami that threatens to plunge more than 100 million people on every continent into hunger. The problem is not the production of food, it is the economic, social, and political model of the world. The capitalist model is in crisis, Chavez said. Cuban Vice President Carlos Laje, visiting Caracas to meet with Chavez and other allied leaders on Wednesday, accused developed countries of spurring food prices through biofuels. Developed countries want to feed the cars of the rich with food. This is the irrational world we live in today, Laje said, echoing Chavez's frequent accusations that Washington's promotion of biofuel is boosting prices of staples like corn.
Ford Canada and the CAW have reached an unprecedented master agreement on a new contract almost 5 months before the current deal expires. The agreement was endorsed unanimously by members of the CAW Ford Master and Local Bargaining Committees at a special meeting in Toronto on Monday. Highlights of the agreement include a 3-year contract that freezes wages but pays a $2,200 bonus upon ratification and $3,500 cash payment in January of 2009 in return for workers giving up some vacation pay. The agreement also offers inflation-indexed pension increases for both existing and new retirees, and extends the life of the St. Thomas Assembly plant, which had been scheduled for closure. While the union succeeded in avoiding the controversial two-tier system for wages and benefits adopted in the U.S., new employees will get 70% of base wages, reaching 100% over the 3 years. Although this round of bargaining with the Big Three was expected to be especially difficult because of competition from lower-cost Japanese firms in North America and because of the large concessions the U.S. auto union offered the companies, CAW President Buzz Hargrove said he fully expects GM and Chrysler to match the pattern established at Ford.
The former chief prosecutor for the Guantanamo War Crimes Tribunal has testified that the hearings were tainted by political influence and evidence obtained through prisoner abuse. Colonel Morris Davis took the witness stand to declare under oath that he felt undue pressure to hurry cases along so that the Bush administration could claim that the system was working. The U.S. Air Force officer was testifying on Monday in a pre-trial hearing for Osama bin Laden's driver, the Yemeni prisoner Salim Hamdan, in a courtroom at the Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba. Defense lawyers asked the judge to throw out the charges on grounds that the tribunal process was too tainted to allow a fair trial. They summoned Colonel Davis to bolster their case. Colonel Davis said he wanted to wait until the cases and the military commission system, which decides which cases to bring and what evidence to use, had a more solid legal footing. He said the Defense Department's general counsel, William Haynes, once bristled at the suggestion that some defendants could be acquitted. He said, "We can't have acquittals," Colonel Davis told the court. "We've been holding these guys for years. How can we explain acquittals? We have to have convictions." The colonel said he resigned as chief prosecutor late last year when officials increased pressure on him to make decisions he felt were inappropriate. He now heads the Air Force Judiciary and plans to retire.
And those are the alert headlines for the week of May the 1st, 2008. This is Alert Radio for people who want to change the world. We have a very special guest for you now, Brian Palmer, who is Canada's preeminent social historian. Brian Palmer teaches at Trent University in Ontario. And you might remember that he wrote the cover story of the May-June issue of Canadian Dimension, which in itself is a pretty special edition. Hi, Brian.
Hello there.
Now, that was an extraordinary piece that you wrote in memory of 1968 and all that happened. For the under 30 generation, though, and many of that generation are among our listeners and work on our show and in the Canadian Dimension office, the title of your article, May 68, An Appreciation, kind of draws a blank, believe it or not. So I wonder if you would just give them and our listeners a quick sketch of what happened that year that made it so important and important to recognize now.
Well, I think what was amazing about May of 68, and really May 68 is shorthand for kind of a broader pattern of developments that happened throughout the year 68 and throughout the later 60s, but it was the massive uprising on a global scale of youthful protest against a wide array of developments which young people and others of the time saw as threatening and saw as dangerous and that demanded kind of immediate mobilizations. I mean, people will associate this mainly, I suppose, with protests against the war in Vietnam, and that was certainly central to massive student protests in the United States, led by Students for a Democratic Society and others, but also in Germany. But there were a range of other protests. The protests in Paris, where May of 68 is traditionally kind of thought to be sort of the central locus of development. Those protests germinated in student discontents with, you know, sort of overcrowded classrooms and very stringent restrictions on their movements. Young men couldn't go to, for instance, women's dormitories, etc. Those protests spread out from student concerns into alliances with trade unions and workers, addressing questions of alienation in the workplace and in the university and in youthful venues, and protests of Vietnam, as I've mentioned as well. And in Paris in May of 68 and in June of 68, an alliance of students and workers essentially fought a general strike that brought the society to a standstill, threatened de Gaulle in power, and really galvanized support around the world. And these kinds of demonstrations happened everywhere, Mexico City, Tokyo, across the United States, across Europe, and also in Eastern Europe, in the then Soviet bloc, where Prague was a center of resistance to what many youth felt were kind of ossified Stalinist forms of containment and repression. So what's really galvanizing about 68 is the spirit of revolt, the spirit of relentless challenge of authority, the demand for change, and the struggle for a better world and a better place in which you happen to be living or spending much of your life.
Well, now, if we can just pause over Paris there for a minute. I believe one of the slogans in the streets was peculiar. Be realistic. It went, demand the impossible. As a matter of fact, we put that on the cover of the special issue. Can you explain what was meant by that?
Well, I think that really is central to this moment of a new left. It sounds incongruous. Be realistic. Demand the impossible. But there are two points to that. The first point I would say is that this new left, this youthful spirit of revolt that animated 68, what it grew out of was not only a challenge to establish structures and authority and conservatizing influences, but it also opposed and vehemently so the limitations of the older left paradigms. Which had too often lapsed into a kind of social democratic quietude and liberal complacency on the one hand, or into, as I've said in terms of Prague, the very fundamental limitations that Stalinism and Soviet-style communism had reached by that point. So the only way to realistically break out of these boundaries of the left was to actually demand what some would say or some proposed were sort of impossibilities. And it was the utopianism, the willingness to sort of jailbreak out of these old modes of left thinking, which were clearly so inadequate, that marked 68 as a major turning point. SDS in the United States in 1962 in the Port Huron Statement, I think referred to struggling for the unattainable, the seemingly unattainable, in order to avoid or challenge the unimaginable. And that's also was something that was there, too, because this moment of 68 really emerged out of the 50s sort of concern on the part of critics with nuclear holocaust. It's the first generation in the post-war world that had lived under the shadow of potentially globally destructive nuclear war. So if you wanted to be realistic and struggle for a world that was different and that was attainable, you had to actually break out of things that seemed set, seemed rigidly in place, seemed unchallengeable. And that really is the spirit of 68, the willingness to demand the seemingly impossible because utopian, revolutionary social transformation was in fact the only way to move forward and to break all the rigid barriers of containment that people were locked into, and many of which, imperialist war, nuclear holocaust, were threatening in the extreme.
But, you know, it certainly caught the public attention. It wasn't self-contained. It was a kind of a blaze of imagination, and just as you describe it. And yet, despite all of that, that it had a grip on the world for a little while, despite all of that upheaval, nothing sustained seemed to come out of it. I'm wondering if you want to challenge that idea, or maybe explain what accounts for the failure of real results.
Well, those are big questions, and I guess I'd be two-sided in my response. I wrote the dimension piece as an appreciation, and so in some senses the criticisms that one might have of 68 are somewhat shelved for another moment. But I do believe that the notion that nothing sustainable came out of 68 is in fact an error. What came out of 68 and what lives in 68 and what needs to be remembered and what needs to be appreciated is that boundless spirit of revolt, resistance, and refusal. And that is the foundation of any movement of social change in our times, and it has been throughout history. Every historical moment that rises, like 68 did, in challenge of the established authority, the conventional wisdoms, is always, in some senses, reaching for the unattainable. And that is the only way one gets to a better place. It often means it comes up short. And because it comes up short, people are willing to say, well, it went up with a bang, came down with a whimper, nothing's left of that movement. That's entirely wrong. A great deal is left of 68, I think, and often in ways that we don't even appreciate. 68 laid the seeds for a whole series of developments that have come afterwards. It changed in some senses, not in every person, but significant numbers of people who lived in that generation of 68, developed kind of new commitments, new ways of thinking about the world, new ways of seeing and living that are with them yet. And I mean, way back in 1988, Dimension, I think Canadian Dimension published a kind of 68 retrospective, 20 years, and you know, it spoke of the sort of continuities even in the midst of the failure to seemingly transform the world that still exists, and I think that's very much there. Also, the fundamental criticisms of 68, political criticisms on the left that I would think need to be seriously thought through and grappled with and developed. And that has been happening, and it's been happening because of people who lived through 68 and who are still grappling with that project. I mean, that's where you don't kill something, a spirit, even though it doesn't necessarily succeed. And I think there are all kinds of ways that Canada was changed and that the world was changed because of 68, and it wasn't changed enough. And it wasn't changed in a thoroughgoing root and branch way. But that's a project that's going to depend on, you know, engaging with that moment and its meanings and its historical messages.
Funny, just listening to you, you just reminded me that everything you just said applies to me. I probably wouldn't be here talking to you if I hadn't been a student and excitable and paying attention at the time to exactly what you're talking about. Thanks so much for doing this interview with us today.
Well, thanks very much for doing what you do and for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Talk to you again, I hope.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
We were talking to Brian Palmer, who is a very, very well-known social historian in Canada, teaches at Trent University in Ontario. And if you'd like to know more of his thoughts on this subject, he wrote the cover story for the May-June issue of Canadian Dimension.
I'm André Clément, and you're listening to Alert. Well, spring is in the air, and if you live in a Canadian city, you have likely seen promotional materials advertising the MayWorks festivities. Mona Ballantyne is Managing Director of Union Development for the Canadian Union of Public Employees. Mona also wrote the introduction to Canadian Dimension's special MayWorks issue on the newsstands now. Mona Ballantyne, thanks for joining us today on Alert.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Mona, for our listeners who are not aware of it, what is MayWorks?
Well, MayWorks is a festival of arts, of culture, and of music, celebrating the contribution that workers have made to Canada, to growing the economy and to just giving everything that we have in this country.
Now, where does it take place?
It's a festival that takes place in a number of cities across Canada. It takes place in some cities some years and other cities in other years. But in most years, you can find MayWorks in Vancouver. You can find it in Winnipeg, in Edmonton, on the around Victoria, in British Columbia, in Ottawa, Toronto, Hamilton, and Moncton.
Now, I understand that we're reaching you in Ottawa today.
You are, yes.
Morna, can you take us to a typical MayWorks, say, in your hometown?
Well, our MayWorks Festival this year in Ottawa has a couple of events. We have concerts with working-class music being played and sung and enjoyed. We also have a poetry night. In the past, in previous years, we've had a lot of theater, as with cabaret-type performances. We've also had exhibits of visual arts. So MayWorks really is a pretty eclectic festival.
So how do you think the arts resonate among Canadian unions? Are they of growing interest? Have they always been?
Well, arts, music and visual arts has always been a very, very important part of the labor movement. Throughout history, unions have used the arts to get messages across and also to build solidarity between workers and between workers and other members of the community. So it's all the labor movement has always been a strong supporter of art. And I think in the last few years, the number of unions have been much more deliberate in their support of the artistic community and have really looked towards cultural expression as a way of getting both building solidarity and getting messages out to larger numbers of people and also more diverse audiences. So I would say that the support of the arts is growing for sure.
Tell me about the audience. Who comes out to MayWorks events?
Well, the labor movement and it's always a challenge to try to reach out to different age groups. MayWorks festivals have been used as a way of trying to reach out to younger audiences. This year, there's been a really interesting collaborative project between MayWorks committees in Edmonton and Toronto and Winnipeg, where they've done outreach to high schools to seek out spoken word poets, young spoken word poets, encouraging them to speak in their spoken word poetry about workers' issues, and then as part of the MayWorks festivals in those three cities, these young artists are actually going to be performing. So that's an example of MayWorks trying to communicate and try to reach out to a younger audience using an art form that, you know, is very appealing these days to a younger audience.
Do you feel that younger people in general have passion for labor, for the labor movement?
Well, my experience in my own union is that when we reach young people, the response has been tremendous. I think that there is strong support among younger people for workers' rights. Younger people are, for example, extremely concerned about issues like health and safety in the workplace. They know that, in fact, more young workers are killed and injured on the job than older workers. That young workers are often, victims of terrible exploitation in the workplace. They're used as casual and cheap labor. So the issues that the labor movement speaks out on have huge appeal to younger audiences. The challenge is for the two to connect. A lot of young workers are not represented by unions because they work in unorganized workplaces. And the labor movement, of course, has to do more to try to organize those workplaces. And that's the way we're really going to connect, is when we actually go out and organize workplaces where young people are working.
May Day, or MayWorks rather, likely kicks off with May Day celebrations. Can you give us a perspective on the scope of it? Is it a one day? Is MayWorks a one day event, a 1 week event? Does it last the entire month? What's going on?
most of the Mayworks committees that are active in cities across Canada organize events around May Day. They usually have events before May Day. Often a number of committees kick off the festival on April 28th, which is the day across the country and actually around the world now, where we mourn the loss of workers who have been injured or killed on the job, and where we commit ourselves to organizing for healthier and safe workplaces. So a number of May Day committees do kick off on April 28th, and then they organize different events that go on, span several weeks.
Morna, where could people find more information on MayWorks?
I think the best thing to do is to buy a copy of the Canadian Dimension magazine, where there's contact information. But the other thing is to just Google MayWorks using any internet search engine, what you'll come up with is contact websites and contact information for different events across the country.
We have been speaking with Morna Ballantyne, the Managing Director of Union Development for the Canadian Union of Public Employees. Morna, thank you very much for coming on the show today and talking to us about MayWorks.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure.
All the best.
Time now for Around the Left in 7 days.
A World in Revolt is Toronto's 22nd annual Socialist May Day celebration. The celebration starts at 7 p.m. on Thursday, May 1st, at the Free Times Cafe. That's 320 College Street. The event will include speakers, a literature display, and surprises. Admission is $10, sliding scale. To find out more, call 416-535-8779 or email Barry, that's B-A-R-R-Y, A-W, at rogers.com.
The group No One Is Illegal is organizing a rally against the unfair deportation of immigrants and refugees in Canada on Saturday, May 3rd, in Toronto. The rally is at noon at Christie Pitts Park, across from Christie Subway. For more information, go to toronto.nooneisillegal.org.
In British Columbia, the Canadian Union of Postal Workers is holding community forums to discuss public services in Canada. The forums will be held on Monday, May 5th, at SFU Surrey Campus from 7 to 9 p.m., and on Tuesday, May 6th, at Library Square in Vancouver, also from 7 to 9 p.m. The events are an opportunity to discuss public postal services and to learn more about the union's vision. All are welcome. For more information, call the union at 604-525-0194, extension 230, or go to publicpostoffice.ca.
There's a free public forum on water on Monday, May the 5th in Halifax, organized by the Nova Scotia Environmental Network. The event is from 7 to 8:30 p.m. in the Rowe Management Building, Dalhousie University. And you can find out more about this by contacting the network on the phone at 902-454-6846, or you can go to www.nsen.ca.
Projecting Change, the Vancouver Green Film Festival, runs from May 8th to the 11th at the Ridge Theatre in Vancouver. The festival features speakers and films that promote sustainable living and increased environmental awareness within local communities. Featured films include Canada's The Fight for True Farming and the U.S. documentary King Corn. For a schedule of films and speakers, go to projectingchange.ca.
And that's Around the Left in seven days. Well, that's our show for this week and this season. Alert is a production of Canadian Dimension Magazine, and we've been putting the show together at the studios of UMFM Radio here at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg.
Thanks to our executive producer, Cy Gonick.
And we also thank our correspondents, contributors Nash Sunwala and Karen McIntosh.
And of course, technician number one, Tommy Allen.
Without whom you would hear nothing. And you can listen to our show anytime at rabble.ca or by clicking on canadiandimension.com. And do join us again in September.
And bring your friends and family with you.
Bye, Andre.
Bye, Les.